The United States is looking isolated. It's looking, once again, like a belligerent bully.
It seems to me that violence of any kind should be the ultimate last resort.
Rumsfeld absolutely refused to answer. Instead, he offered, quote, "The absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence."
We're talking about the fact that America is the chief exporter and breeder of violence at home and around the world.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch from Monday, January 6th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When President Bush unveils his economic growth package tomorrow, he will propose wiping out the taxes shareholders pay on dividends, a step that would cost the Treasury more than $300 billion over a decade. The White House struck back today at Democratic charges that the Bush plan is skewed to the rich, with spokesman Ari Fleischer rolling out statistics suggesting it is focused on the majority of the American people who are the middle class. One area scheduled to take a big hit in Bush's wartime budget is domestic spending. When the GOP-controlled Congress swears in over the next few days, domestic spending will be held down to $316 billion. This in the face of soaring outlays for defense and so-called homeland security spending. The cost of an attack on the people of Iraq is estimated to range anywhere from $99 billion to $1.9 trillion over a nine-year period. That's according to a recent study written by William Nordhaus. Others warn that many of the costs of waging war against Iraq are hidden. Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research predicts security costs alone stemming from the threat of terrorism could run upwards of $100 billion a year.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one thing to keep in mind, we've already increased our security at the airports. You know, we have much greater screening all sorts of places, public, baseball stadium, wherever you might go. There's been an increase in security. But that's only a fraction of the way that we could conceivably go if we actually faced an enhanced terrorist threat. And if you want a case study here, look at Israel. I mean, look at the precautions they take. And the point, the $100 billion figure I've said, was suppose we had to do as is now the practice in Israel, we have an armed guard stationed outside of every retail establishment in the country.
And so you're saying that would drive our cost up to about $100 billion a year just to protect against those type of threats?
Exactly, exactly.
How likely is that, though?
Who knows? I mean, you know, it's very difficult to say, you know, how many people might be willing to take up terrorism, you know, under what circumstances.
I really meant how likely is it that the retailers in this country would move to putting in security guards? Are you suggesting even the small retailers or restaurants?
Well, as I understand it, I mean, I don't know this from direct knowledge. I haven't been to Israel, but as I understand it, pretty much every retailer now has a guard at their door because if they don't, people won't go in. You know, the fear of, you know, of a suicide bombing is so great that, you know, that people won't go into a store if there's not a guard there.
And there, in fact, is a cost to this society that is probably difficult to calculate. How do you calculate not having a free and open society? What is the cost to that?
I mean, I think of, you know, hearing stories, you know, reading things on papers, or hearing stories second, third hand from people in Israel. I mean, the idea that, you know, you're worried about sending your kids out to play because, you know, there could be a terrorist attack. I mean, that's, you know, that's crazy. I don't think anyone would want to live like that. So, you know, you could try and put dollars and cents on that. But, you know, as a practical matter, I think, you know, we'd all consider that a disaster.
On the other hand, more security jobs would become available if we want to move into a police state, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's not the best way to have employment, I don't think.
When you estimate this $100 billion a year to protect against terrorist threats, does that take into account preparations for possible chemical or biological attacks against this country as well?
No, this is just a very simplistic estimate. This is just identifying one source of protection that, you know, in Israel has become the norm. But, you know, if we looked at all the other ways in which we conceivably might have to increase security if we thought that there was this serious terrorist threat, you know, it would be the $100 billion is just the tip of the iceberg.
We talked about the creation of possible security jobs, but really on a more serious note, the Bush administration is expected to put a lid on domestic spending. We are seeing articles being published, one, in fact, today in the Washington Post, suggesting that the Bush administration will be holding down domestic spending to about $316 billion in the current fiscal year. Do you have any sense of how that compares to estimated defense spending for this current fiscal year?
I haven't seen how much they expect to increase the military budget, but obviously that is on the up. I mean, basically we've already seen a large increase in the military budget on the order of, you know, from when Bush took office, it's around $300 billion. Now we're spending around $380 billion, and then another additional $20 billion increase in expenditures on Homeland Security. So we've seen a very large increase in, you know, in the military defense side of the budget, and obviously in part that shows up in a larger deficit, but in part that is coming at the expense of the domestic budget.
Mm. What specific programs are likely to suffer under a scenario where defense spending is far outpacing that of domestic spending? I know we have a critical need for affordable housing in this country. Millions of Americans can't afford health care, and the infrastructure of schools across the country are in serious need of repair.
Yeah, I think we're likely to see pretty much across-the-board cuts. I mean, you know, education had been an area that, you know, President Bush came in and said he wanted to increase support for, and actually his first budget did do that. But, you know, I think we'll probably see some cutbacks there, maybe less than in some of the other areas. But, you know, given the amount that they're looking to cut or are likely to look to cut in coming years, because this is, again, just that, you know, we're going down a path of higher spending. We're just, you know, taking the first steps to this point. You're probably going to have to see cuts in just about every area of domestic spending. And the only question is, you know, where will it be the more, where will it be less?
White House spokesman Amy Call is quoted in today's Washington Post as saying, "We've been saying for a year the country has three big priorities: fighting terrorism abroad, protecting our homeland, and ensuring economic growth. Other functions of government will grow more slowly than in previous years. We can't make the mistake of trying to have guns and butter."
Yeah, well, they want to have lots of guns, and they don't seem interested in having much butter. So,
what's the poverty rate in America?
Well, the poverty rate, that's a good question, actually. I believe it's around 12% going up. You know, part of that is, well, I shouldn't say part of it, but the main reason is the recession, which they can't be blamed for the cause of it. They can be blamed for not responding effectively. And, you know, here too, one looks at their stimulus proposal. I mean, we don't have all the details, but it's clearly going to be tilted very heavily towards more tax cuts towards the wealthy, which, you know, how that's going to stimulate the economy is very, very difficult to see. How even in the best of all worlds, I mean, what they could possibly be thinking, if you want to give them credit for saying that they have a stimulus package, it's very hard to see how this proposal would stimulate the economy.
Any hidden cost to this in this scenario that we haven't talked about so far, Mr. Baker?
Well, there's endless hidden costs. I mean, if we end up antagonizing much of, you know, the Arab Muslim world, maybe much of the developing world more generally, we're going to pay huge costs for that for a long time. You know, we mentioned the terrorism that, you know, may or may not have come about. I don't know that we will, but insofar as it does prompt terrorism, you know, that's a horrible thing that, you know, we might have to live with, a real, you know, day-to-day fear of terrorism. That would certainly be tragic. There's other costs which we will feel if, you know, people have hostility towards the United States. It's a safe bet that, you know, U.S. exports will suffer. Boeing's going to have a lot harder time competing with Airbus if the people at the buying end just really don't like the United States. You know, we go to the developing nations, we want them to respect our copyrights when, you know, Disney is selling them their movies or DVDs or, you know, their music, whatever it might be. We're probably going to get much less cooperation on that. I mean, you could think of an awful lot of ways in which the United States and U.S. citizens will pay a cost if, you know, our actions in Iraq are seen as bullying, that we're seen as an aggressor, and it creates a lot of hostility in the developing world.
Is there any really precedence for that, though? I mean, I'm inclined to think that probably, regardless of what the U.S. politics are, if there's some products or things out there that these countries need and want, they will go ahead and purchase them.
Well, it's rare that, you know, the days long past that the U.S. had a monopoly on anything. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, people, if they want to get Boeing, they have the option to get Airbus. And if the people making that decision really don't like the United States, then they'll likely go to Airbus. I don't think they'll go without a plane. You know, if Boeing had the only plane there, they would buy it from Boeing. But, you know, given the choice, you might see a lot of people switching to products that aren't made in the United States. Once in the Times had an article about this about a week ago about how there's this coal that's being put out in, I think it's throughout Europe, that is meant to compete with Coca-Cola, and it's quite deliberately intended for people who don't want to buy a U.S.-made product. Apparently it's selling quite well in Islamic areas, heavily Muslim areas.
Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Amid swirling snow, the hospital ship USNS Comfort churned out of port today to aid in a possible war with Iraq. Across the country, more than 4,000 Marines and sailors left San Diego early today for a six-month deployment to the Persian Gulf, and more than 10,000 Army soldiers in Georgia were preparing for deployment tonight. The Washington Post reports today that the U.S. military is amassing as many as 100,000 ground troops in the Persian Gulf region for invasion of Iraq. This despite the Bush administration's repeated claims that it's still pursuing diplomatic channels and has not yet decided whether or not to launch attacks. What's often overlooked in the hawkish rhetoric, however, is that with over a decade of economic sanctions and regular bombings by American planes policing the so-called no-fly zones, the war against Iraq has never really ended. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with independent journalist Jeremy Scahill, who spent a lot of time reporting from Iraq for Free Speech Radio News and Democracy Now!
Well, the no-fly zones cover a huge amount of Iraqi territory, some 60% of the country, the northern part of Iraq, where there's a predominantly Kurdish population, and then the south of Iraq, where there's a predominantly Shiite Muslim population. Saddam Hussein is a Sunni Muslim and has a minority Sunni government in Baghdad. The stated policy of the U.S. is that the no-fly zones are there to protect the Shiites in the south and the Kurds in the north from Saddam Hussein. But what they have done on the ground, and I have seen this firsthand, is to maintain an utter state of terror, particularly in the south of Iraq. Under the Bush administration, we have seen a dramatic escalation in these attacks on Iraq. And far from being attacks on Saddam Hussein's forces, they end up being de facto attacks on civilian populations that have been repressed and terrorized by Saddam Hussein for years. And now they're being bombed once every 3 days, now more recently once every 2 days, by U.S. warplanes. And so people who may have been predisposed to support some kind of a rebellion against Saddam Hussein now have lived under 10 years of continuous bombing and escalated bombing under George W. Bush. And they're saying essentially that they're going to fight or shoot at any American forces that come in there. So, you know, upwards of 300 civilians have been killed since 1998, according to the United Nations. The Iraqi government says it's much higher, 1,400. I can't confirm that number, but I can say that I've met many people who have lost family members to U.S. missiles. And this has to be taken into account when we hear about these massive troop buildups going on in the region, because U.S. forces are likely going to experience stiff resistance from even anti-Saddam Iraqis in the south of Iraq.
Stiff resistance, perhaps, but of course, the U.S. military will outnumber by far any kind of troops that can be assembled on the part of Saddam Hussein, which will probably, in essence, make it ending up being much of a bloodbath. That's the perspective that we're hearing here in the States. What can you add to that?
Well, there's no question that the U.S. military could pound Iraq in a matter of 48 hours and absolutely raise the country to the ground. What I'm saying, though, is that if the U.S. intends to move into Iraq with a full-scale occupation, in other words, not just massively bomb the country and try to destroy Saddam Hussein's ability to further defend Iraq, but if they actually try to move in on the ground, I don't think that they're going to experience the biggest resistance from the Republican Guard or the Iraqi army. I think that we're going to see a kind of guerrilla warfare or urban warfare scenario unfold. And this is something that I don't think any American would like to see U.S. forces get into in Iraq. And you also have to factor in that there is an increased interest in Islam in Iraq, and many people are participating now. And there are also some severely fundamentalist elements backed by Iran in the south of Iraq that are calling essentially for jihad against American forces if they move in. There's no question, you're right, Verna, that the U.S. could absolutely raise Iraq to the ground. The forces are much more powerful. What I'm saying is if they want to occupy Iraq, they're going to have a very difficult time doing that without losing thousands of American lives.
Part of the Bush administration's agenda is to depose or assassinate or displace, whatever word you care to choose, Saddam Hussein, who they say is a dictator. In fact, I heard White House spokesman Ari Fleischer on the television moments ago in responding to a question from reporter Helen Thomas that the Bush administration has no quarrel with the people of Iraq, but that the people of Iraq are in no position to select their own dictator. You've been stationed in Baghdad for some time now. What do the people of Iraq say about the rule of Saddam Hussein in the context of this impending war?
Well, I think the British Member of Parliament, George Galloway, who's traveled a number of times to Baghdad, put it very accurately. He said, millions of Iraqis hate their president, but millions of Iraqis do not hate their president. And I think it's a very simple statement, but I think it's an accurate one. There's no question that the majority of Iraqis have lived in an utter state of terror since Saddam Hussein came to power. There is no question that people would like to see him go. But the fact of the matter is that now things have even changed since I first went to Iraq in 1998. I think now that the hatred for Saddam Hussein has been eclipsed by the hatred for Washington's policy and particularly the Bush family. And so I think we're going to see a very complicated dynamic unfold where you're going to have even anti-Saddam Iraqis fighting against U.S. forces. I do not think that in large parts of Iraq you're going to see any cheering on of U.S. forces if they come into Iraq. But there's no question, Verna, that an Iraq without Saddam Hussein would leave Iraqi people better off. But the fact of the matter is the U.S. has no right to come in and change that government. And the U.S. policy, one way or another, whether directly or indirectly, has supported Saddam Hussein against the Iraqi people. For all of Saddam Hussein's transgressions and all of his anti-democracy, that is now being eclipsed by the fact that people in Iraq perceive Bush as having a direct quarrel with them and punishing them for things that they had nothing to do with.
Independent reporter Jeremy Scahill, who's reported extensively from Iraq. You can listen to his regular reports at his website, iraqjournal.org. For the past 4 weeks, the Peace and Social Action Committee of the Live Oak Friends, a Quaker organization based in Houston, Texas, has held a weekly peace vigil at a busy downtown intersection near City Hall. Renee Felt from Pacifica Station KPFT caught up with two members of the group on New Year's Eve, and she files this report.
For 1 hour, every Tuesday at noon, Burnham Terrell and Catherine Vanderpool stand quietly among workers walking by on their lunch break. They hold a sign facing oncoming traffic with simple wording that reads, "Silent Witness for Peace." Following their vigil on New Year's Eve, the two friends, as Quakers call themselves, explained the purpose of their action when they spoke with KPFT News about their views on something called the Peace Testimony.
As Quakers, we think there's that of God in everyone. And, you know, I would hope that George Bush and Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein could at some point find that of God in each other. I'm not saying that I'm anti-military. I think the military has a very important role to play. I think the life of a soldier is an honorable one. Be willing to sacrifice oneself for one's country is an ultimate sign of dedication and loyalty, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I want to make sure that what we're doing abroad is the right thing. And it seems to me that violence of any kind should be the ultimate last resort.
As far as the Quaker perspective and tradition is concerned, it goes back to George Fox, who founded the Society of Friends in England, and who proclaimed to King Charles II in 1660 what we call the Peace Testimony. And his words were that we utterly reject all wars and strife and fighting with outward weapons for any end whatsoever and under any pretense. This is our testimony to the whole world. Now, I have known and respected some members of the Society of Friends who were not pacifists. And the range of opinion, even among friends, though the tradition is the peace testimony, is very broad. And so far as this particular vigil is concerned, it's not based just on the peace testimony, by very many other considerations. The notion of a unilateral, preemptive attack on another country is, I think, just wrong. And whether you defend pacifism or not, I think one could argue that the United Nations, we are a member of by treaty. Treaty is the law of the land, and Article 2 of the Charter of the United Nations says that it is wrong for any armed attack on another country is forbidden under the United Nations Charter. Self-defense is permitted, but there's nothing about unilateral preemptive attacks. So it's very clear that by the United States Constitution and the United Nations Charter, in which we participate by treaty that is constitutionally defined as the law of the land, we have no business mounting an armed attack against Iraq.
Now, if you can only fit that on your poster board.
And say that's independent of the pacifism.
We may be silent in worship, but we have a lot of ideas about how this situation is unfolding. One fear I have is that we're overextending ourselves. That I don't see how we can wage a war on terrorism, invade Iraq, deal with North Korea, work on our economy, and maintain our society as it is. It seems like we are on the brink of taking a path that will have very severe consequences.
I was interested in seeing how people responded to your vigil. Part of the reason you're out here is probably because you want to tap into something, like you said, that many people share with you that may not be expressed. Have you had any interaction with people, and what have their responses been like out here?
Well, the first time we came out here, a couple people honked at us. A couple people gave us a finger.
The thumbs up finger, not the middle.
The other one. We got the middle finger.
I didn't see that.
And we got a couple thumbs up, and we got a couple peace signs. I just hope we're making people think about what we're doing. Gandhi once said that whatever we may do is insignificant, but that's what we must do. And if we can just make people stop and think about this, maybe it'll rub off on them. Maybe they'll rub off on someone else. And that's how I think you get things going.
That piece was produced by Renee Feltz of Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston, Texas. We'd like to welcome KPFT to Peace Watch's Drive Time slot. As we begin a new year, Peace Watch wants to reaffirm our commitment to peaceful resolution of conflict in Iraq. We thought it was important to clearly articulate the compelling reasons for continuing to oppose the U.S. aggression against Iraq. In a recent speech at Boston University, author and teacher William River Pitt shows how the U.S. has manipulated public opinion and U.S. foreign policy to ensure U.S. control of natural resources in the Middle East. In his book, War on Iraq, What Team Bush Doesn't Want You to Know, Pitts and former U.N. Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter dismantle the myths surrounding Iraq's present weapons capabilities to uncover the neoconservative forces behind the White House's push for war on Iraq. Pitt and Ritter go on to explore the White House's premise for war, demonstrating, among many startling revelations, the utter lack of any plausible link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. We learn that Osama bin Laden is in agreement with the Bush administration and has called for the death of Saddam Hussein. Pitt and Ritter highlight the absurdity of Team Bush's dual aim of bringing down Saddam Hussein and forcing democracy on a nation that has been divided for centuries. We conclude this three-part series, Making the Case for Peace and Historical Perspective.
No weapons inspecting team has set foot in Iraq since 1998. The inspectors, including Scott Ritter, believe Iraq technically capable of restarting its weapons manufacturing capabilities within 6 months of their departure. That leaves some 3.5 years to manufacture and weaponize all the horrors that have purportedly motivated the Bush administration to attack. Technically capable, however, is the important phrase here. If no one were watching, Iraq could do this. But they would have to start completely from scratch, having been deprived of all equipment, facilities, and research because of the inspector's work. They would have to procure the complicated tools and technology required through front companies, which would be detected. This is first world technology. You don't make this stuff in a cave. The manufacture of chemical and biological weapons emits vented gases and would have been detected by now if they existed. The manufacture of nuclear weapons emits gamma rays that would have been detected by now if they existed. We have been watching via satellite and other means, and we have seen none of this. If Iraq was producing weapons today, we would have definitive proof, plain and simple. And yet we march to war, and soon. What motivates this, if not hard facts and true threats? It comes down to opportunistic politics and a decade of hard anti-Hussein rhetoric that has boxed the Bush administration into a rhetorical corner. Back in 91, the UN Security Council mandated the destruction of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Sanctions were placed upon Iraq to pressure them to comply. The first Bush administration signed on to this, but also issued a covert finding that mandated the removal of Saddam Hussein. Even if all the weapons were destroyed, Bush Sr. would not lift the sanctions until Hussein was gone. Bush Sr. and Clinton after him came to realize that talking about removing Hussein was far, far easier than achieving that goal. Hussein was, and remains, virtually coup-proof. Rousing a complacent American populace to support the massive military engagement that would have been required to remove Hussein by force presented insurmountable political obstacles. The tough talk about confronting Hussein continued, but the Bush and Clinton administrations treaded water. This lack of results became exponentially more complicated. Politicians began making a living off demonizing Hussein and lambasting Clinton for failing to have him removed. The roots of our current problem began to deepen at this point before it became acceptable to encapsulate a nation of 20 million civilians in the guise of one man. In 1998, the Republican-controlled Congress passed the Iraqi Liberation Act. The weight of public American law now demanded the removal of Saddam Hussein. The American government went on to use data gathered by ONSCOM, narrowly meant to pinpoint possible areas of investigation, to choose bombing targets in an operation called Desert Fox. This was in complete violation of the UN charter that had been set up to create ONSCOM in the first place. An open letter was written to Bill Clinton in the fall of 1999 condemning him for failing to fully implement the Iraqi Liberation Act. It demanded that he use the American military to facilitate the Iraqi opposition's operations inside Iraq, to put troops on the ground and move on up to Baghdad to get rid of Saddam Hussein. Who signed this letter? Don Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Armitage, Robert Zoellick, Richard Perle, and several others who have since become part of this new Bush administration. The removal of Saddam Hussein became a plank in the GOP's race for the presidency in 2000. It's in the platform. You can look it up. After gaining office, George W. Bush was confronted with the reality that he and many within administration had spent a great amount of political capital promising that removal. Once in power, however, he came to realize what his father and Clinton already knew. Talking tough was easy, and instigating pinprick military confrontations was easy. But removing Saddam Hussein from power was not easy at all. Then came September 11th. Within days, Bush was on television claiming that the terrorists must have state-sponsored help, and that state sponsor must be Iraq. When the anthrax attacks came, Bush blamed Iraq again. Both times he had no basis whatsoever in fact for his claims. The habit of lambasting Iraq and the opportunity to escape the rhetorical box 12 years of hard-talking American policy had created were too juicy to ignore. Defense Secretary Rumsfeld appeared before NATO not long ago and demanded that they support America's looming Iraq war. Most of the NATO nations appeared ready to do so. They trusted that America's top defense official would not come before them and lie. But when they tried to ask questions about it, of him about the basis for this war, Rumsfeld absolutely refused to answer any of them. Instead, he offered this regarding our utter lack of meaningful data to support a conflict. Quote, "The absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence."
Author, high school teacher William Rivers Pitt, speaking at Boston University. Thanks to Mark Weaver of community station WMBR in Boston for that report, and to Peace Watch editor Lona Elias for preparing that. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.